Welcome to the Resilience Rising podcast with me, your host, Jen Scottney. With the help of my guests, we will be getting curious about what resilience is, how we develop it, and the times we've used it. This podcast is here to explore all things resilience. Today, I'm talking to Claire Rutter. Claire is a micro-adventurer and explorer, a paddle sports and outdoor enthusiast. Claire was British Canoeing She Paddles Ambassador for Canoe Wales, and she paddles in the South Wales and southwest of England. Claire is a survivor of a life-changing traumatic brain injury. In 2016, she was living her dream life in Gran Canaria when, without warning, she collapsed. Claire began the uphill task of years of recovery. She initially remained housebound for 6 weeks, ill, confused, and in a state of fear of the predicament she found herself in. In her current day guest speaking, Claire talks of the last photo, a tear-jerking emotive moment where she believed she was about to die, alone and scared, in a foreign country. Whilst coping with her illness today, known as post-concussion syndrome, Claire is now a full-time qualified paddle sports instructor and leader and regularly supports clients with neurological conditions, mental health issues, and a range of disabilities, enabling participation, enjoyment, and progression in paddle sports, utilising the outdoors as therapy and rehabilitation as she did. Welcome to the podcast, Claire.
Thank you. Wow, what an introduction that was.
Well, I had to try and cut lots out. You've done so much and do so much. So I just wanted, but yes, what an amazing journey you've been on.
It's been interesting, yes, for sure.
And one, to me, once I started seeing snippets of your story, which I think was on through my own paddling and on some of the paddle boarding groups, I just knew I wanted to get you on the podcast because I have no idea how you got through what you have got through. And so I'm so interested to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm still trying to figure that out myself as well. So maybe I'll get some answers today.
Oh, have we not got, you know, 5 easy points to resilience? Here you go. I'm finding it's not that simple.
No.
Before we get on to your story, I'm really interested to hear what resilience means for you.
For me, resilience is about not giving up. It's about reflecting and learning from experiences, deciding what thoughts and actions are useful. And I guess with something I'm interested in at the minute is Tao philosophy. And sort of key message there is about not dwelling too much on the past, but not anticipating too much for the future either, but considering and staying in the now. And I think that is what really keeps me going.
Wow, that's really interesting. So before we hear about that, what that means to you, just give us a little bit of background. So before your traumatic brain injury, you were living in Gran Canaria, and I said it was like living your dream life. Just give us a little idea of what it was that you were doing there and what your life looked like before the injury.
Yeah, so I'd always wanted to move to somewhere nice and warm. You know, I was always one of those freezer types. So the thought of living amongst palm trees and seeing lizards on a day-to-day basis and just generally being warm, that was a real appeal to me. Originally, I wanted to go to Australia, but I got a little bit too old for that, so I aged out. So years later, I went on holiday with a group of friends to Gran Canaria, and I instantly fell in love with the place and the people. There's lots of British people there, but there was also a lot of Spanish people, a lot of local people, and a whole bunch of, you know, people from around the world living there as well. So it was really, really nice. Out there, when I was living in the UK, I was working in criminal justice. But out there, I had to go back and rely on some former careers of mine, which was chefing and bar work. So obviously being a key sort of primary holiday destination, you do what you can, and it is generally feeding people and housing people. And yeah, just giving them things to do in the area. So yeah, that's what I did. I did whatever I could. In those key hotspots.
And outside of work, what sort of things were you doing there? What do you have an active life?
It was pretty active. I, you know, sort of depending on what time I was working, I'd maybe hit the pool or the beach before work, after work. Sometimes it would be both on the same day. I go and hang out with friends just around their pool, just go and chill out, basically. A few months after I got there, I realized how much I missed volunteering, because it's something I've done from sort of the age of 16 onwards, and I was really starting to miss it. My main volunteering up until that point was probably in the Scout Association in the UK. But I wanted to, because I was out there and I was pushing my boundaries and doing something completely different with my life, I wanted to do something different volunteering wise again. So I put out a message on the local sort of British Facebook group, look, I'm looking for some volunteering, you know, what's around, what can you recommend? And this lady that I'm still very good friends with now, Daniela, she's Bulgarian. She came through straight away and said, I'm the volunteer coordinator for the Spanish Red Cross, Cruz Roja Española. Please come and join us. And that's exactly what I did. So I went and did some volunteering with them. I was working with the emergency response unit. I was down the local port supporting, you know, people who'd come off the boats that you hear about coming across quite regularly. And I was working in the food bank as well. So the Red Cross had its own food bank out there. So I'd be up there chopping up, you know, bunches of bananas ready for people, picking up oranges from the local farmers. Yeah, just quite varied, really enjoyable.
It sounds a really full life. And then it changed, as I talked about in the introduction. Before that life-changing day of the brain injury, was there any signs that there was any illness? Was there any issues that you'd been having? Or did this come completely out of the blue?
I'd say it was mainly out of the blue then. I'd had a little sort of fainting episode when I was younger. I don't know whether it was similar or not really sure. But yeah, it came completely out of the blue. I, you know, from going from feeling perfectly fine and well one moment, I suddenly went to feeling very, very ill, the worst I'd ever felt in my life. It was quite short-lived in terms of me feeling it, because I'd say maybe 30 seconds after I was thinking I've got to get home, apparently I was out, I'd passed out, I'd hit the deck. Yeah.
And where were you?
A lot of things.
Yeah. Sorry. Where were you when this happened? Were you out in public?
Yeah, so I had a friend, Hope, who worked in a restaurant. She was one of those ladies or guys who'd be outside a restaurant saying, come on in, come and get your pizzas, come and get your snacks, cocktails, 2 for 1, or whatever, 1 for 2, who knows. And yeah, so she was working, but it was always the case of she, you know, if customers were coming along, it was always the understanding between us that I would step back, let her do her thing, you know, because at the end of the day, she was working. And that's what happened. And it was while she was talking to somebody that I suddenly felt this unwell. And I had to say, look, I've got to go. I'm not feeling well. And I felt quite guilty. I remember feeling quite guilty about that, saying that at the time. But I knew I was going to pass out. You know, the feeling I had, which was, I've always described it as a hot lava wave coming up my spine, into my neck and into my head. Yeah, just incredible warmth. But I knew it was not going to lead to good things. What I should have done in hindsight was sit down, sit down on the floor. And I think I might have been okay. I think I would have still passed out, but I might have been okay. But I took the decision to try and get home, which was a 2-minute walk around the corner. But yeah, I said, look, I've got to go. And yeah, took 2 paces and that was it. The rest I was told about.
And what happened after that?
It resulted in, so at the time, it's apparently I was convulsing. I was having a seizure on the floor for about 5 minutes. I was unconscious overall for about 30 minutes. So just hearing about that afterwards was quite scary in itself. An ambulance did come. They called an ambulance straight away. My friend was obviously there taking care of me. I became a priority, which her boss wasn't too happy at the time, but hey. There was actually an off-duty British nurse who happened to see what happened, and she was there sort of tending to me as well. An ambulance was called. And I, once I'd woken up and come around, I was sort of looking up. I could see the pizza board lights with all the pizzas on, all the different varieties, and I was like, what's going on here? So seeing an ambulance, being helped into the ambulance, I knew I'd done something pretty bad. I could feel that my face was kind of numb and kind of buzzing. So I knew I've had quite a few head injuries in the past. I think I've had five previous to that one. So I knew I'd done it again. I knew I'd used my head. People say use your head, so that's what I do. So yeah, I got taken in the ambulance, assumed I was being taken up to the main hospital to get checked out. But I was actually taken to the local health centre because they did not believe that I was a resident. They thought that I was a tourist out on the drink. So what happened in that time was they were hoping that my friend, who was a fairly new friend, so she hadn't even been over to my house by that time. So I had to give her the key, explain how to get to my actual apartment, and find my paperwork. I didn't have my phone on me at that time because when I'd finished work that night, it was a last minute decision to go and see this friend. And I put everything on my sofa apart from my key. I had my key in my pocket, and that was it. So even when I was at the health centre, I had no way of communicating with my friends or knowing if she found this paperwork or not. It didn't happen because eventually I was then blue lighted up to the main hospital, which was about 40 minutes away. So this is going on for what, 2.5, 3 hours after the actual incident. In the hospital again, I thought, right, great, I'm gonna get sorted out. This is fantastic. The waiting room that I was put in, it was quite late at night by that time. It was dark, it was absolutely freezing, the aircon was cranked high. I literally had a cotton sheet to keep me warm. And I was basically left in this waiting room for about 8 hours. I was on my own. And very occasionally someone would just come and check on me, but I felt very, very alone and just not very well looked after, unfortunately.
And did you know that something life-changing had happened at the time?
I don't think I thought at that time that something really serious had happened, but I was obviously in quite a daze, so I couldn't think anyway. I didn't know all night what I'd done to my head and my face, because on the occasions that I visited the bathroom, there was a mirror in there, but I couldn't bring myself to look at the result of what I had done by hitting the pavement with my face. But eventually that morning, I sort of plucked up a bit of courage and I looked in the mirror and wow. Yeah. There was already some bruising coming in. My forehead was really starting to swell. My ribs were starting to hurt by that time, and I learned later that I'd cracked those as well. My nose was slowly like spreading sideways. It was swelling. And I found out again as well that I'd broken my nose as well. I did have some sort of I had a cut to my head. I had some sort of like scraping on my nose. But yeah, up until that point, I don't think I really knew the realities of what was going to come after it.
And in the introduction, I talked about that last photo where you had this moment where you believed that you were about to die alone in that country. When did that happen? Was that in this period that you're talking about, in those 24 hours afterwards, or was there more to come in terms of that?
No, this was probably, I'm going to say, around a week to 10 days in. So as the hours went by and the days passed, the swelling was just getting worse and worse. I mean, it literally looked like I'd been in a huge fight with somebody, you know, spent 10 rounds in the ring kind of thing. So I was in agony, obviously because of all the swelling and everything. Obviously I'd bruised things, I'd broken things. And I was steadily feeling worse rather than getting better, feeling in a lot more pain. But I've totally forgot what you asked me, sorry.
I was asking about when you had that moment that we were talking, that we mentioned about when you thought that you were going to die. But you're saying that that was in that week afterwards, that things were getting worse.
Yeah. So that photo, when I put that photo up on Facebook, I genuinely thought that I was not far from death at all. I hadn't even been living in the country that long by the time it had happened. So I only had a few close friends, really. So a few friends sort of came over and brought me food and things, but it wasn't that often. So I felt very, very alone. I felt, I don't know, just completely helpless, I guess. And yeah, I literally thought that I was gonna pass away on that sofa at that time. So yeah, I took that photo, and something I would not normally say, people who know me know I would not normally say, but I put with that photo just a little comment of those times when you need your mum or when you want your mum. For me to write that, people who know me, for me to write that, that's quite extreme for me. You know, I try and think I'm a little tough nut, but that was me showing my vulnerabilities, I guess. But yeah, I wanted to put it up there because I thought, well, if it does happen, then, you know, there's something to show that I knew it was coming, I guess.
And we talked, when you talked about resilience right at the start, you talked about resilience being that not giving up. I mean, were there times during this period, which was only, we're talking weeks after the injury, where you really did feel like you just wanted to give up? Or if there wasn't, like, what was keeping you going during that time? What helped?
That's a tricky one. I mean, obviously what I realized a little bit later was that my brain wasn't working. I couldn't think like I was thinking before. I wasn't able to process really what was happening. I knew I was in a bad state, but I couldn't think of solutions. Literally nothing was coming to me. My brain was so not working. I had nothing.
So was it just a case of surviving?
I think so. I think it was minute by minute. Mm-hmm. At that point, I didn't know what was going to happen. Even just sort of, you know, getting up to go to the bathroom or going to bed, you know, going to get a drink from my kitchen. They were all humongous tasks. You know, the most part of that 6 weeks, I was on the sofa because that was the easiest place for me to be sort of relative to those areas that I had to visit. It was a very strange moment during that initial recovery.
And then from after that 6 weeks, did things start to improve slowly, or was there more to come in terms of how you were and your symptoms?
The physical impact of what had happened, so all of the bruising, that stayed with me for a good 6 months. That took a long time to reduce. The swelling, I mean, that, you know, if anyone's had sort of a goose egg from a head injury before, I mean, I had the mother of all goose eggs, you know, and I had that for months and months. So I wasn't actually able to even go and volunteer with the Red Cross for quite a while, not just because I didn't feel great, but because of the type of people that they tended to work with and support. I looked like a victim of domestic abuse. So, you know, I couldn't even do that. And I've totally forgotten where you were going again. Sorry.
It's all right.
Remind me.
I was asking just about those, that time after the 6 weeks, just getting an idea of what you went through. But you mentioned about that initial medical care that was delayed when you had your fall. How was the medical attention that you received after that? We've talked about you were largely just sent away to your house for those first 6 weeks. Were you still receiving care? Did anybody explain what was happening and have a treatment plan for you?
No, I had absolutely nothing. So from the moment that I was discharged back home, it was actually my volunteer coordinator who came to collect me. So yeah, from that point, I had nothing. I went to the doctor a couple of times and said, you know, look, I'm really struggling here. Sorry, I've lost it again. Sorry.
No, it's fine. So we were talking about medical care.
Previous question.
It's all right. No,
don't
worry.
Like I've missed something out of that.
It's all right. We'll start again. I was asking about the medical care that you had.
My life.
I'll keep this in for the full effect of what this brain injury has done.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I was asking about the medical care that you had when you'd been, I keep saying release because I used to work in prisons. That's really not the language for hospitals, discharge from hospitals.
Yeah, so when I was released from hospital, I wasn't really left with any instructions or anything like that. It was, you know, I was given some very lightweight painkillers, nothing much better than paracetamol, really.
Really?
And I was discharged home. Yeah, no, honestly, you couldn't write it. You couldn't write it. Yeah, so I was discharged back home. My volunteer coordinator, Daniela, she took me home. But yeah, being able to even go to the doctor myself, the doctor's was several miles away from where I lived. But because I was so housebound, it was very difficult for me to even get up off the sofa. So going and getting a taxi or, you know, walking, that was just not an option at all. I was far too ill for that. But I did see the doctor a couple of times in sort of the weeks and months following, as and when I could. Eventually I was saying, look, I really think that something more is going on here. I don't feel like I'm recovering as I should be. And he eventually did say that he was English speaking, that he could refer me to neurology, but it would be all in Spanish. Now that, funnily enough, that wouldn't have been a problem previous to my head injury, because my Spanish was actually very good at that point. But what I found in the weeks following, and as I was starting to realise what I could do, what I couldn't do anymore, and things were becoming a little bit more clear, I realised that I was forgetting words, and trying to learn new words was almost impossible. I was just not retaining things as much as possible. So I mean, it wasn't even a major decision, but not really, you know, not what people would imagine it to be. But I knew that I had to come back to the UK. I was not well. I was not well enough to be there. My work, you know, I'd gone back to work, you know, sort of several weeks later. And I knew I was making mistakes, and I realized how I was having to mask so much of my behavior and how I was working, because I was not right. You know, my brain had been affected. And once I'd realized that, yeah, that's when I decided that I would have to come back to the UK, ditch that dream life that I'd always dreamed of. And yeah, I wasn't getting that medical care out there. And I thought, right, I know in the UK that I will get that care and attention that I really need.
So you've mentioned about those cognitive difficulties that you were having, and what were the other symptoms that you were having at that time?
So sleep was severely affected. So I'd be awake for hours and hours at night when, you know, I should be sleeping. So sleeping wasn't great. My balance was all over the shop. Yeah, just, you know, not being able to think. Headaches, migraines, I've suffered with those from being a kid anyway. But from that head injury, yeah, blown out of the water, like insane levels of migraines. that would last for days, you know, not just a few hours, but days on end. A 4-day headache, for example. When I wasn't working, there was not a lot more of that sort of sunbathing or, you know, sort of things like that, being out with my mates. When I was not working, I would have to lay on my sofa or go to bed to try and claim back as much energy as I could, because I was suffering with fatigue very, you know, quite severely, in order to have enough energy for my next shift.
And with that, those levels of pain and that limited quality of life compared to the life that you had before, it must have affected your mental health during that time. What was that looking like?
Yeah, that was not good at all, really. My, you know, I've always been fairly open about mental health. You know, I have always suffered with sort of mental health and anxiety and social anxiety. But from the time that happened, and as I was realizing that I couldn't do the things that I could do so easily before, I just thought, my life is over. My life has changed. You know, can I go back to paddling? Can I go back to walking in the mountains? Can I do this? Can I do that? Can I do archery? Have I got the energy to do that? No, I do not. And yeah, it was pretty soul destroying. Slowly realizing that I wasn't who I was anymore.
I'm just nodding, because there definitely echoes how I felt through my chronic illness and then my injury and not being able to run anymore. And I've had so many moments where I just thought that all my best days were behind me, and what could I do that was fun in the future? But we're here. We did get through. And
totally relate to that though.
Yeah. And that question of identity as well, particularly when I had so much of my life built around running in terms of friends and careers and just time that I spent. So did you have hope? It sounds like from how you've just described that scenario, that it was quite hard for you to have hope. But ultimately, did you have hope that you would recover? Were there signs of improvement? Were there things that you could grasp onto to give you that hope?
Well, I think that making that decision, which, like I say, it wasn't a huge decision for me. It was quite an easy decision to come home. That was my glimmer of hope. I knew that I would be listened to and taken more seriously with my UK doctors. Before I left, I took the decision to have a tattoo sleeve done on my left arm. And what I had done was, you know, sort of drawings of a lot of the outdoor activities that I did prior to my injury. And it was, I think mainly when I had it done, it was mainly to remember who I was. But as time went on, it became a motivator to get back to who I was before.
And when you came to the UK, did you receive the care and the attention that you were hoping for? How did that go? And talking in terms of the medical care and attention, but I hope you got other care and attention, but I meant in the medical sense.
Yeah, no, when I, you know, I came back to the UK, I had to go back to the doctors to register. I had to wait about 10 or 11 days before that first appointment. The reaction from the doctor just was phenomenal. It was fantastic. I mean, I was sort of explaining my story to her about what had happened, you know, like with the seizure and the, you know, all the convulsions, the level of unconsciousness, the amount of time I was unconscious for, all of that. All of what had been happening since, and that I hadn't recovered from the concussion, I was still effectively concussed for 24 hours a day. As I recounted that story to her, she was literally mouth open in shock. Once I'd finished sort of explaining everything that had happened, and I had to write it all down, because that's what I have to do, because, you know, my memory is not great. I have to write things down. So I gave her those notes as well. So she couldn't believe it. What she did was, right, I'm putting you on anticonvulsant medication. I am going to signpost you for an MRI, for a CT scan, x-rays. I'm going to signpost you to the brain injury team. And she was magnificent. So literally everything then was falling into place. By that point, whatever damage was done to my brain, it had obviously already happened, and there was probably very little that could be done after that. But all of those things were then put in place for me. They knew where they were with things. I kind of knew where I was. I had this amazing nurse from the brain injury team who came over and worked with me for about 10 weeks or so. She came to visit me at home. And what she did was actually, you know, do certain tests with me and things. And what that helped me with was understanding what parts of my brain had been affected and why, and what tactics, what little things that I could do to try and help me live my life, basically, and try and progress my life and try and strive towards being even a tenth of who I was before and the things that I used to do.
It sounds really positive, especially just all that support that you were getting once you came to the UK. I mean, was it so always such this positive linear journey of just improving, or were there still difficulties that you had? And when we talked about those mental health struggles in particular, was there still tough days that you were going through, even though you were getting this support?
Yeah, there were definitely tough days, and there still are now. The nature of my injury is it's mainly the fatigue. The fatigue is what, you know, is a real killer for me, because it is so unpredictable. I mean, I could have a really good day, you know. I do archery and things now, and you know, I could be feeling quite good and feel like I've got quite a bit of energy, and then I'll shoot for a bit longer because I'm really enjoying it and I'm feeling quite normal. But then I'll completely pay for it the next day. I could do nothing on one day and just rest, but the next day I could be extra fatigued. You know, it's very, very unpredictable. So those days were like that as well. And obviously I was trying to come to terms with what happened and sort of the symptoms that I'd been left with. Yeah, just up and down, really. Mental health sort of flowed kind of at the same time as the fatigue going up and down, I'd say. I think by that point, I was starting to get, this thing is not going to beat me down. You know, I'd never been a quitter ever in my life, stubborn as anything. and I use that stubbornness. It's like, this is not going to hold me back. You know, I am Claire Rutter. This is not what Claire Rutter does. You know, Claire Rutter does not sit down, lay back and give up. And I didn't.
Well done. And what are the sort, just before I've got some other questions, but just kind of bringing us up to date, what are the sort of symptoms that you've been left with? Because now we're talking like 8 years afterwards, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, now the fatigue is still, you know, that still really gets me. I have to pace myself. So obviously I've learned a lot of little techniques for how to try and pace my energy out. And, you know, I try not to take on too many things because it saps my energy, you know, sort of physically, mentally. Headaches and migraines, they still really get me. But I've recently been put onto some sort of newer medication to tackle the migraines and actually as well the nerve pain. The damage that was caused in my head and my face left me with nerve damage, so I've recently been given medication for that as well, and I've forgotten again.
That's fine. I wanted to ask about that hope you said about the hope of getting back to normal. And I know that when I was suffering from fatigue and chronic illness, I swayed between having the hope that I would get better because it somehow made me go forward and not give up. But then I often wondered whether an acceptance of this is my life now, live in the now of what I've got, would actually bring me a happier life. And I never really, for me, if I had the energy, I'd prefer the hope one. But I just wondered, do you still strive and aim for that hope that you will get back to normal? Or do you feel like this will be your normal and that's okay?
I think this is my new normal. I don't think I would ever say that it was okay, because I will always want to do more. I will always want to be better. But I think for me, it is a case of, I feel that it's easy to give up. It's moving forward that is the challenge. And I've always loved the challenge. I mean, to quote a friend of mine, she basically said, "I really admire how you think and how you dust yourself off and keep climbing. You have incredible strength and such a great mindset." And I love the way that she wrote that, as in, I don't move forward, I keep climbing. And I really, really like that, because I think moving forward, you can sort of move sideways as well. But the fact that she says keep climbing, I think that really goes with the kind of person that I am. I will always keep putting one foot in front of the other, one hand above high. I will keep climbing, and I will just keep trying to be the best person, the best of myself that I can be, despite all of these, you know, symptoms and disabilities that I've been left with. So yeah, but it'll never be okay. But that gives me the motivation to keep trying.
And just, you talked about that Tao philosophy of not dwelling on the past, but it seemed to me there were some things that, like questions of, had it been different? Had I got different care? Had I sat down? And I just wondered whether these are some things that you dwell on, or is it that you stop yourself dwelling on them? Like, is it something that can lead to action? Is there any point in dwelling on those issues in your story?
Yeah, I mean, I do still think about those sort of, you know, when it happened and that initial care or lack of care. And I, you know, it's quite a major time in my life. You know, I can't help but think back to it and think, would things be different? But as bad as it all was, and the experience I've had and the injury I've been left with, I almost see it as a positive, because when I was there, I was living a very fast-paced life. You know, work consumed me. I wasn't, when I look back at it, I was not having the best time of my life. I thought I was, but I really wasn't. You know, I was neglecting myself. So really what happened, it gave me the opportunity to come back home and kind of start again and do things properly, start from the beginning and actually look forwards and again, recreate myself, you know, start anew. I had all these symptoms, you know, I still have all these symptoms, but every day is a new opportunity. You know, some people who have less impact, less injury than I had are no longer here to tell the tale. It killed them ultimately. So the fact that I wake up every morning, it's a new day, and I seize that day, and I try to get the most out of every day that I can and just be positive about it.
Wow, Claire, after all you've gone through, to come through saying that could be a positive for reasons, I find really powerful, because it's not that you're ignoring what's happened. It's just that you're making the best and finding the positives in something that's really, really shitty. and have you always been a positive person, or do you feel like what you've gone through, particularly as you say, like some people would not have survived this, has that changed your outlet? Has it made you more positive?
I think I've always tried to be positive, and I think it's because I've always been aware of my mental health not being great. So many, many years ago, I decided to do this thing that for every negative thought that came into my head, that I would think of two positive things. And I think by keep doing that, you know, keep on doing that, that even before an injury, you know, that changed my brain into thinking much more positively. You know, so before injury, I was, you know, I'd be laughing around, joking around, you know, I'm known for always smiling and being happy and things like that. A lot of people obviously don't see what's behind that, you know, but, you know, yeah, I do suffer with my mental health, but I do try and think positively. And I think since injury, because I had that, because it happened, I'm even more positive.
Wow.
And that's just how it is.
And when you talked about resilience being kind of thoughts and actions, and those as a decision, is this the sort of thoughts and actions you were talking about? I love this idea of challenging yourself and acknowledging the negatives, but then thinking of two positives. Like what else are these thoughts and actions that you intentionally take to be resilient?
What's really key for me, and it's always been a thing for me, is my greatest fear is to live with regret. I never want to have not done something because I was too tired or too ill. I will do things when I'm well enough, obviously, but just not doing something that I want to do is quite soul destroying. So I will make sure that I do those things, you know, even if I can only go for a 5 minute walk one day, or just even sit in the garden, and just a little thing like that is really important, and it gives me those kind of mindful moments as well to reflect on what's happening, what's important. Fresh air, hearing the birds sing, you know, hearing the kids play in the park, you know, just little things like that are really, really important. And those are the things that really make me smile and sort of keep me being positive.
Oh, yes. And when I was ill and couldn't get out, I had so much pleasure from just listening to the birds and hearing them and watching them on my bird feeders. And if you'd have told me that years ago, that would be what was bringing me joy, the most joy on that day, I'd have thought, oh my God, my life's so boring. But now, to me, that is the important things, because it's every day. It's like, right, it's around us all the time. So tell me a little bit from, we've got that you came to the UK, you've finally got some medical assistance, and although you've still got symptoms, at least you were getting support and working on the what and treatment for what you could do. How did you get to have this active life that you've got now with your outdoor work?
So I can credit that pretty much to the nurse who came to visit me from the brain injury team. So, you know, I was on a lot of medication at that time, so that was making my fatigue kind of a bit worse. But she was like, you know, I'd like you to get into some volunteering and sort of, you know, think about ultimately when it's right to get back into the workforce and give me that sense of purpose back. You know, I've never liked not working. I always enjoy working. So I said to her that I was already back assisting in Scouts. You know, I've got a very long history in Scouts of being a Scout and being an adult volunteer as well. And she said, well, you know, that's great, but what else can you do? And this what else is something I think about every day, not relating to that, but relating to a whole bunch of things. What else? What's next? What else can I do? Right, come on. So, yeah, so she said, you know, what do you like doing? And I was like, you know, I love the outdoors. I love doing activities outdoors, or I used to. So I said, well, I've got this friend who runs his own adventure business. So she said, you know, can get in touch and see what you can maybe do there. So I was like, okay, yeah, I'll give it a go. So I messaged this guy and, you know, I said, you got 5 minutes, love to have a chat, you know, wondering if there's sort of any opportunities coming up. And he messaged me back saying, are you looking for work? We're looking for staff. And I was just like, oh, wow. Just that message alone was just like a huge glimmer of hope. I thought it was beyond my reach at that point, but I was like, yes, this is great. This is fantastic. So yeah, basically I went for kind of like a fairly informal interview. I explained how I was now with my symptoms and what I could do, what I couldn't do. And he was willing to take a chance and, you know, sort of give me a bit of voluntary work here and there, which was amazing. So yeah, I was starting to do things like going out on trips, coast steering, bit of kayaking, bit of stand-up paddleboarding, you know, just things like this, going away for a night camping with a youth group or a school group. So just little by little. And I could feel, I think because my fitness was starting to come back, I felt like I had a bit more energy. So this was really good. So this was really positive for me. So yeah, eventually he said, right, I would like to start paying you for a few of these shifts. And I was like, this is fantastic. So great. So yeah, so that's what sort of started happening. And at the end of the season, you know, I hadn't worked for him for too long technically by that time, but towards the end of the season then he was we'd like to offer you a full-time position.
Yay.
And that just blew my mind completely, to come from what I'd come from to be offered a full-time job. Yeah, it blew me away completely. So I did have to have, you know, a good few stern words with myself and like, right, can you do this? Because obviously with the outdoors, there can be a lot of risk involved. You know, the outdoors is great fun, but there's a lot of safety stuff to it, a lot of risk assessment, you know, and considering my own risk was vital. I didn't want to make myself out to be something I wasn't. So I had to think very carefully. And I was like, right, come on now. Can I do this? So I was like, right, of course I can do this. I'm Claire Rutter. I can do anything, you know. So I was like, yeah, okay, this is great. So yeah, so he offered me this full-time job and I was like, yeah, let's do it. So yeah, I was about to start this job and I thought, yes, my life is finally getting back on track and get some experience and then hopefully start working on some qualifications. And yeah, lockdown hit, that famous favorite time for us all. I know, soul destroying.
And I imagine, but, it was like even worse, like for people that could run or walk, it was just, you can do that from your doorstep in most places. I know we had limits on, but I can imagine that you spend so much time paddling and that would have just been really impossible to do under some of the restrictions in terms of traveling, and unless you have something on your doorstep, it would have been really hard. So I imagine that it was hard for you, lockdown.
Yeah, it was difficult. I lived out in the countryside, which was very good in one way, because it meant that I could, you know, go for a little walk. You know, me and my mum got into a routine where we'd go for a little walk at 3 o'clock afternoon when we're on lockdown. The rules were different in Wales at the time. And whereas in England, people could, you know, I think at some point you could travel for up to 30 minutes away and go and do your exercise and everything. We couldn't do that. We had many more restrictions placed on us. So on the early lockdown, we couldn't paddle. You know, Canoe Wales said no paddling. And for those of us who paddling was extremely important for, not just for the fitness, but for the mental aspect and, you know, all of that. It was awful. It was such a horrible experience being in that time. But as the restrictions eased, we were allowed to travel for up to 5 miles and go and paddle. You know, in this time, you know, when we're on massive lockdown, I'd bought myself a paddleboard. I couldn't go and use it. But yeah, then we could travel for up to 5 miles, which meant then I had my local river and I had the beach. So yeah, that's what I went and did. So I did a lot of paddling initially, but yeah, eventually Wales opened up, as did everywhere else. And yeah, I could expand the horizons for paddling.
And tell me why it is paddling that you love so much and what that brings for you.
Trying to get that down into a few words. Wow. I've paddled pretty much since I was about, I think it was about six. Yeah, I was about 6 years old. I went to a open day at an activity centre with my parents and I tried kayaking. I don't remember it, unfortunately, but apparently I really enjoyed it. Yeah, I think because I joined, you know, Brownies Guides, eventually I moved over to the Scouts when, you know, they let, you know, Scouts let girls in eventually. It, because we lived in a very sort of coastal area and we had the rivers, paddling was always an activity that was always on offer. So yeah, I was always kayaking or canoeing when I was younger. And when I came back from Gran Canaria and eventually got back working for that adventure company, out of all of the activities that I was doing, that I was sort of taking part in and sort of assisting with, it was the paddling out of everything that was really grabbing me. And I think the reason for that is that sort of healing power of water. Just floating on water, listening to it, the feel of it, just all of it for me is it's just magical. I can't explain it in any other way, really. Yeah, it just, the water, even if it's absolutely freezing, it makes me very happy.
I mean, you know that I'm preaching to the converted here because I love it too. I think you mentioned before about mindfulness, and to me, I find it really mindful on the water, whether it's just because I feel away from the hustle and bustle of life, because generally I'm like the only one out there, and it's just so different from just walking down a path or something like that. I just feel like, for me, it gives me another perspective. But yes, I find it very mindful. Or just, and do you as well? Is that something that you get from it?
Yeah. I mean, I've spoken about mindfulness quite a lot in the past, and in relation to the water. I think just being on the water, you don't even have to deliberately have a little 5 minutes of mindfulness. Mm. I think it just happens. I think I'd like to think it happens for most people, but I think, you know, if you can imagine, you know, whoever's listening, your local canal or your local river, if you've got some kind of footpath that walks alongside it, the point of view that you have if you are on the water is very different than if you're walking at the side.
Mm.
You're very much more in tune with it, I feel. You're a lot closer to the wildlife, you know, which isn't great for everybody, but you know, you are closer to the ducks, the swans, you know, you see the fish jumping out of the water, like right in front of you. If you're on the coast, you know, you've got seals swimming not far from you. You know, you can just see everything so close up. And especially with the paddleboard, what I really like about the paddleboard is going on the sea when it is flat calm, and you're standing up, which gives you a great viewpoint for looking down into the water. And one of my most favorite memories is looking down and seeing crabs walking across the bottom of the ocean. Just amazing. And the jellyfish are phenomenal. I mean, you know, a lot of people are scared of jellyfish. I keep away, you know, but seeing them in their natural environment, I feel very privileged to be there. And it gives me such a sort of warm, fuzzy feeling, you know?
Mm. And I mentioned about, and I think this is how I came to know you, is that you were an ambassador for She Paddles. So we've talked about those very personal benefits, but you clearly are so good at creating community and offering this to others. So tell me a little bit about your She Paddles ambassadorship.
When I was working for this guy as a venture company, there was an opportunity came up, a voluntary role, a voluntary opportunity with Canoe Wales under British Canoeing, you know, about being a British Canoeing She Paddles ambassador. Now, for 3 years prior to that, British Canoeing had run this every year. So you generally spend a year at a time in this role, you know, different people every year. And it was the first year that Canoe Wales had come on board. I had already met the sort of volunteer coordinator already a few times. And I, you know, she had said it to me that she really loved my enthusiasm and my passion for paddling. And she thought it would be a really good idea for me to apply for the role. Now, that role was obviously never intended to happen through a lockdown, which none of us were expecting. But yeah, we'd literally just gone into lockdown. And obviously my mental health was taking a hit because I was suddenly getting some freedom back, and then it was whipped away all over again. So yeah, she rang me at probably the best time possible. And she said, "Claire, we'd love to offer you the role. If you're willing to accept it." So for many, many reasons, not just getting women and girls on the water, you know, because obviously there wasn't that high statistics of women and girls on the water at that time. Not just because of that, but I knew it would give me a massive boost to my mental health. It would get me thinking more about paddling and getting people to network and share ideas and all of that, rather than thinking we're stuck at home. So it was really important for many reasons. So yeah, so it was, you know, the lockdown wasn't, you know, we weren't expecting that. But I, as I do in many parts of my life and what I've always done, I try and think of the things that you can do rather than what you can't. So yeah, so it's like, right, how do I motivate other women to get out on the water when we're not allowed out on the water? You know, it was a crazy paradox. So yeah, so I thought, right, let's get some networking going. So I suggested about getting a Facebook group together. So we did that. As the country was unlocking slowly, we were allowed to go beyond the 5 miles in Wales. So on this Facebook group, I posted, "I'm fancying a paddle in Newquay, West Wales on Saturday, if anyone would like to join me." So a few people straight away were like, "Yes, can't wait to meet you. Yep, can't wait for this paddle." The conditions were expected to be fantastic. And then this lady at Canoe Wales, Gail, my volunteer coordinator, she rang me and she said, "Claire, there's women and girls that really want to come to that paddle that you're going to on Saturday, but they haven't got any of their own equipment. Can you help out?" So I spoke to my boss at the time, and I said, "You know, look, this is what's happening. Is there any chance I can sort of borrow some gear?" He was very, very supportive of what I was doing. You know, he was really chuffed with the fact that I was then a British Canoe ambassador. So yeah, so I basically went from expecting to go in my little Fiesta with my roll-up paddleboard and, you know, a few bits of my own gear, to having to go and pick up the massive works van loaded with kayaks and paddleboards and buoyancy aids and helmets and everything. And you know what? I don't think I've ever paddled in more perfect conditions. The sun was slowly setting in the sky. The water was flat as anything. You could see North Wales on that day. It was that clear. It was such a nice day. And yeah, so basically we met. There was a bunch of us, women and girls. None of us had met each other before. We went out on the water. You know, we did a few briefings and things like that. And we went out on the water and, oh, wow, just everyone had such a great time. And it was like lockdown had never happened, just for that sort of hour or two that we were out there. And by the end of it, you know, everyone was like really thankful and like, "Great to meet you," and all of that. And it was left with just a couple of us then, and Gail, my coordinator. And you could not get those grins off our faces. We literally couldn't stop grinning. Like, my face was hurting from grinning at that point. And I just said, "We should go on tour with this." And basically that's what we did. So a week to the day later, we were at North Dock in Schleswig, which is a lovely little spot for beginners. And we were there with 25 women and girls ready to have an intro session to paddleboard, canoe and kayak. And it was amazing. So that one day was like a pilot, but we hoped that we could do more. So within literally weeks, we had, I think it was 6 dates. They were fully booked for every single one of them. We were on the road somewhere different every week. posting about it on social media. There were people on the waiting list wanting to get onto it. And at the end of it, we had an expedition day as well. So yeah, it was a very positive time in my life. But what it meant was the passion that I had for paddling and just for life in general by that point, because I was getting my life back, it was motivating other people to do that as well. And I still get messages now as well, which is really nice, from women saying, I'm doing this now, I've become an instructor, or I take my kids out now kayaking, or huge.
Amazing story. Just so much there. We talked about the benefits, but then to add in all this community, people trying it for the first time. Wow, that's so good. Well done, Claire, for everything that you achieved with that.
Thank you.
And I mean, I would really like what a perfect happy point to end it. But I know that you wanted to mention, just because this is some work and that you've been doing, is that a few years ago, you were diagnosed with melanoma, and I know that you wanted to just talk about the risks of that, because it seemed like a stroke of luck that you had your diagnosis and you found this. So I don't want to bring the vibe down too much, Claire, but I do know that it's important to you to talk about that. So what happened in 2022, or a few years ago, when you got diagnosed?
Yeah, I mean, it still seems quite fresh. Mm. Again, I've managed to find some positives through it, strangely enough. But yeah, I spotted this mole that wasn't looking quite right. It was starting to sort of, you know, get a bit of a funny texture. There was various colours coming out of it, sort of yellows and reds and things. But this was in lockdown, and it was very difficult to obviously see a doctor at that time and speak to somebody. And I think I just kept ignoring it, basically. I don't know whether I thought it would just go away, but after that, I met somebody, a girl, and yeah, she saw this mole, and she happened to work in the department in the hospital that receives those kind of samples, so those kind of samples of moles, to test them for cancers and things. So as soon as she saw it, you know, I don't know whether it was fate or what, but she said, you really need to get that looked at, like, now. So she stressed the importance of it to me. I did get onto it straight away. That gave me the sort of boost I needed. And literally within 2 weeks, I was having my first surgery to remove it, to go off for testing. And as it turned out, she was very much part of that process in her lab. She actually was part of dealing with that sample, which was kind of a bit crazy. But yeah, it turned out that it was melanoma. It was melanoma skin cancer. She was very, very good at supporting me through that process, because obviously she knew a lot about what it was. So yeah, I ended up having two surgeries overall. I had to have some lymph nodes removed as well, and that was basically to check that the cancer hadn't spread. So skin cancer is a very real thing. Melanoma is the deadliest of all skin cancers, so early treatment is key. And I'm now very much part of, you know, trying to promote sun safety to people. And the reason I possibly had it was from living abroad. Possibly one of the first questions they asked me was, have you ever lived abroad? You know, and obviously I did sunbathe a little bit abroad. I never had been a sunbather before that. But yeah, it was... Who knows? The fact that I was working sort of 14 plus hours a day in the outdoors, very, very difficult to keep putting sun cream on when you're in that position, and you're kind of sweating that sunscreen off as well. So yeah, again, I saw the positives out of all of it. I had a very rough time with it. My second surgery, I had sepsis as well. I was quite poorly with that. But, you know, it made me think more seriously about looking after myself. like my brain injury had given me, what is right for me. So yeah, that, you know, that's what I did. That's my favorite, that, again, now.
Well, I'm just still here in a daze, like amazed that you keep finding the positives when, no, I'm kind of maybe not doing justice to myself, but I'd be like, I would feel very sorry for myself. Why has this happened? Probably a bit of sobbing on the sofa as well. But you seem to be able to find the positives in these things. I mean, do you feel that that's key for resilience, is finding the positives and seeing them as a call to action as well?
I really think so. I mean, there's so many terrible things that happen in our lives, but it's those bad times that make the good times even better. So, you know, one of the decisions that I made because of having that melanoma was I realized that I couldn't be out in the sun for 14 hours a day working and, you know, not applying sunscreen as often as I, you know, should have been, probably. So I had a slight change of career. I do still do some freelance outdoor work, but yeah, I do very much more of an indoors job now. I keep away from the sun. When I am out in the sun, I am factor 50 all the way, regularly applying it. I'm currently working with a company now to sort of talk a bit more about sun safety, and with Paddle UK, formerly British Canoeing, and encouraging people to really take care of themselves and their skin. You know, it's very easy with other things in our lives. We know what a healthy diet is. We know we have to go to the dentist and take care of our teeth. But in Britain particularly, we're very poor at looking after our skin. But the reality is that the rates of skin cancer are going up dramatically. And it affects a lot of people. And, you know, knowing you've got something like that, that you've got a cancer growing inside you and you can't do anything about it, you know, the fact that you can protect yourself as much as you can by putting the sunscreen on, by wearing SPF protection clothing, it's little actions that can help protect you from potentially what was a period of hell for me, going through a cancer diagnosis and surgeries.
Thanks for sharing that and giving us that info as well, Claire. So apart from, you mentioned about that advocacy that you're doing there, what else have you got coming up, and anything else exciting in the pipeline?
I am shortly to be working with a company promoting some outdoors inspired streetwear, so I'm very excited about that. So I'm going to be doing a few sort of almost modeling shots of some of their gear, so I'm very excited about that. The reason I've sort of gone with that opportunity is I'm very much into recycling and sustainability, organic produce and things like that. So everything they do is organic products, and for every product bought, it either goes towards planting a tree or removing plastic from the ocean. So it's very much topics very close to my heart. I'm also an RNLI ambassador for water safety as well. So I'm going to be getting some messages out soon about paddling on the coast and taking care of yourself and being aware of the risks associated with water and tides and such. Yeah, I've got a few little projects coming up.
And how can everybody...
Very exciting time.
It is really exciting. I never know what you're going to say. I wasn't expecting the streetwear project to come up. But own it. You're modelling it. And how can people follow you?
So, yeah, I'm on social media. My main social media, I would say, is my Facebook page. So I am Claire, which is spelled C-L-A-R-E, followed by Rutz, which is R-U-T-Z. It's a bit of a play on my name. So Claire Rutz Rutter is the same actually for Instagram and TikTok. If anyone's on X, I'm @Claire_Rutter. and LinkedIn, you should just find me by entering Claire Rutter.
Ah, and I will put all those in the show notes as well. Claire, you have been an inspiration. And the next time I'm wallowing, feeling sorry for myself, I'll be thinking, what would Claire do? She'd find some positives. She'd take some action. She'd move forward, keep climbing.
Definitely.
And as I've been interviewing you, I keep looking up and above your shoulder, you've got a sign that says dream the impossible. I can't read the bit in the middle and then achieve greatness. And I feel like...
Seek the unknown.
That pretty much sums up...
Impossible, seek the unknown. Yeah, achieve greatness, yeah.
Claire, that sums up your life. You've done it. Tick it off.
It is. And wherever I've had that for a long time, that little picture, and wherever I've lived, I've had that up on the wall. And in those little moments of feeling low and feeling like all hope is lost, I look at that and I'm like, right, come on, let's find some positivity. And it always works. And you know, I'd be devastated if anything happened to that picture, you know. It's very important to me. It's even part of my tattoo, very simply: dream, believe, achieve.
Amazing. And just incredible words to end on. Thank you so much, Claire, for sharing everything of your story and just being an inspiration. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Resilience Rising podcast. If you have enjoyed this episode, please do help people find us by hitting subscribe, leaving a review, or sharing us with others. Thank you so much, and see you next time on the Resilience Rising podcast.